Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you once again for tuning in as we bring you another peek inside the big old monster box of baseball cards here, buried in a dark corner of a dark closet in my house and just rummaging through them. And we're going year by year, set by set. And this episode, we get back into the cards with a look at 87 Donruss in our random pull. Card number 265, one Eric Davis. Yes, Eric Davis in his prime with the Cincinnati Reds. I was very fortunate to see him, not in person, mind you, but certainly on television during his prime and that World Championship with Cincinnati back in 1990 before, unfortunately for him, a lot of injuries really plaguing his career after that championship season, but quite the impressive comeback story and quite the set, 87 Donruss, as we go digging through the monster box once again. Now, before we go diving back into the monster card box, I do want to say thanks to Brad Baloukjian, the author of the Wax Pack book. Again, waxpackbook.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at Wax Pack Book. He was our guest on the previous podcast. A little change from the norm for us, not looking at the cards or an individual player, but talking about the very unique project that Brad is on, writing a book about tracking down 14 former major league players. These were players that were randomly pulled from a pack of 86 tops. So thanks to everybody who chimed in and also who retweeted our link out to other friends. And as always, I tell you, if you have a friend who collects or who used to collect, we got a lot of people who used to collect, or you know, maybe you collect now, but not as much as you did when you were a kid, very much like me. A lot of people are starting to kind of get that 80s and 90s nostalgia, and no better way to do it if you're a sports fan than through baseball cards. So I always implore you, think of one friend who you know collects or used to collect who would like this. Send them a link to one of our podcasts. Tell them to follow us on Wax and Gum Stains. And we certainly appreciate your efforts to help pass along this podcast and this whole project of ours to all of your friends. And one other quick little housekeeping note before we talk 87 Donruss and Eric Davis. I sent out a tweet a couple days ago, and I'm sure a lot of fans will be very excited about this. We are working on getting approved by iTunes, so you can listen to the podcast practically anywhere. Now, if you've ever dealt with iTunes and trying to get a podcast approved by them, it does take some time. It can be a little frustrating, but I've had quite a few fans reach out and say, hey, we love the podcast, but can you get it on iTunes so that I can listen to it on a device that I prefer listening to it, or you know, we can expose the show to a whole new group of fans. We're working on it. Might take a few weeks, but as soon as we get word that it is approved of by iTunes, we will certainly let you know. Now, normally at this time of the podcast, I stop to go through the fan mentions, the questions, the comments at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, and you're always welcome to give me a line, drop me a line, ask me a question. It doesn't even have to pertain to a particular podcast, although that's what most of the questions and comments pertain to. But if you just have any question about the hobby or a question about me, again, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter handle. It's open 24/7. Just send your questions and comments, and we like to reserve a few minutes out of the podcast to talk about it. But I'd like to do something a little different this time before we talk about 87 Donruss and Eric Davis. I want to talk about the late Jose Fernandez. And a few weeks ago, I dedicated a podcast to Gene Wilder, who was a very influential comic and actor in my life, a very tough loss for fans of comedy, and certainly for me. And this podcast I want to dedicate not only to the life that was Jose Fernandez, but everybody that he touched. And he touched a lot of people in his very short time on this planet, only 24 years old. And only in the spotlight for much of the general public for maybe 6 or 7 years, if that. Of course, you probably know about his story about trying to escape from Cuba. It took 4 times for him and his family to escape from Cuba. The boat capsizing, he jumps into the water, saves his mother, is able to cross the border in 2008 between Mexico and Texas, settles in Tampa, Florida. A star pitcher at Alonzo High School, drafted by the Marlins in 2011. And he had a phenomenal shortened career. And this despite losing a season with Tommy John surgery. I mean, this guy was really hitting his stride, as a lot of young talented pitchers do at the age of 24. But Jose, as you've heard a lot of the commentary over the last couple of days, really just loving baseball, loving life. And a lot of it goes to his efforts to get out of Cuba. And, you know, you could certainly see that while he could be intimidating on the mound, he also was full of just energy and joy and love and life. And unfortunately, that life cut way too short in a boating accident late Saturday night, early Sunday morning. Officials still not exactly clear on when it happened. The boat was discovered very early Sunday morning, and two other passengers on that boat passed away as well. I'm sure the lurid details of that night will eventually come out, but the fact is, three young men with three close families, with lots of friends, and of course with Jose Fernandez, an extended network of friends through not only the Cuban community in South Florida, but also back in Cuba and baseball fans worldwide. This is just a really tragic event. And it hits close to home for me for a couple of reasons. One, as I mentioned, he went to Alonzo High School in Tampa. Well, I live in Tampa. I've spent most of my life in Tampa. And I remember when Jose Fernandez was drafted in the first round by the Marlins back in 2011. It was a really big deal. And of course, when any local kid gets drafted first round by a professional sports team, it's a big deal. But you have to think, too, about the rise and fall and steady rise of baseball talent, young, exciting, good baseball talent coming out of the Tampa Bay area. You know, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, Tampa was just an absolute hotbed of baseball talent. I can think back, of course, Al Lopez goes back way, you know, back in the 1920s. But thinking of other players like Tony La Russa, Lou Piniella, and then once you move up the years, you had Dwight Gooden, you had Fred McGriff, you had Louis Gonzalez, Tino Martinez. And for those of us growing up in the Tampa Bay area, for the longest of time, this was a baseball hotbed. That was until the early 90s, and it's not just in the Tampa Bay area, but really throughout America, where football and youth football really overtook youth sports for a couple of decades. All of a sudden, the talent level in the Tampa Bay area heading to baseball was dropping as everybody was starting to make the switch to football. So when Jose Fernandez was drafted in the first round in 2011, that was really, really big news. But another reason why his death hits close to home is this past weekend, my six-year-old son and I, we were doing a father-son weekend because, as I've mentioned several times before on this podcast, my schedule gets very, very busy right now, actually. Preseason hockey is starting. I work for the Tampa Bay Lightning. And in just a few weeks, the regular season starts, so things really get humming this time of year. I was able to get together enough time and a few bucks to get my son. We hopped in our car and we drove down to Miami. And one of the big reasons why we wanted to go to Miami was because my son likes the Marlins. He also likes the Rays, too, and I'd say he equally likes them. And that's mostly in part because both teams are carried on local regional sports networks that we get here in Tampa. So we've got baseball on the TV all the time during the summer. So we had planned this for probably about 2 months. We picked September 25th against the Atlanta Braves. I figured that would be an easy game to get tickets for. It was the last weekend before things got really busy for me. And of course, Sunday morning, in fact, it was right after we ate breakfast at our hotel. It was about 9 o'clock. We were about to head out and do a couple things before going to the ballpark. That's when I found out about Jose's death. And, you know, as a father, it's not easy to discuss death with a six-year-old because that is a time where children are just starting to understand the concept of death. Sometimes they may be really afraid of it, maybe anxious about it. Other times they may be rather esoteric about it, and it's just kind of this whole different world, death. And my son, you know, he's dealt with the conversation of death before. We had a nephew who passed away from cancer at the age of 6. My father-in-law passed away even before I started dating the woman who would become my wife. So, you know, we've had discussions about death and, you know, what happens and how people die. But it's never easy 4 hours before you're supposed to go to a baseball game to say, "Son, do you know who Jose Fernandez is?" "Well, of course, Dad. He's one of the Marlins' best pitchers." "Okay, well, I've got some sad news to share with you. You know, that's not an easy thing to do, and it's not easy to say, I know we were planning on going to this baseball game, but I think there's a good chance it's going to get canceled. And sure enough, just minutes later, we found out it was canceled. Now, the good news is, you know, my son took it in stride. He understood, of course. We go to a lot of baseball games. We either go to, you know, a couple Tampa Bay Rays games, a few, you know, during the season. We go to quite a few Tampa Yankees games. That's a minor league team, Florida State League team here. So, you know, in many ways, it was just a game. But we were able to go out and still have some family fun and you know, spend a little quality unplanned time on Key Biscayne at the beach. So it's all good. But, you know, it's a four-hour drive back to Tampa. And while my son is sleeping in the back seat, I'm just sitting there thinking about, you know, Jose's family and how much this has to be just driving them mad. I mean, just 24 years old is just so young. And chances are, if you're listening to this, you're over 24 years old. In fact, you're probably 34 or 44 years old. If you think back to when you were 24 years old, you had the world on a plate. You were probably 1-2 years removed from college. You were finally starting to get your career rolling. And at 24, you can kind of see ahead. You know, you see your career kind of laying out a little bit. Your personal life, you know, maybe you've had a long-term girlfriend and you're thinking about marriage, or maybe you're starting to plant the seeds of, hey, one day I'm going to have a family. You know, there's a lot that's right there just within your grasp. And with Jose Fernandez, that was the exact same thing. I mentioned his career. I mean, it's everyone knows how phenomenal his career was going. And he was a big reason why the Marlins were doing so well this year. But, you know, a personal life, too. You know, he had a girlfriend who is pregnant. You know, unfortunately, that's a whole nother difficult subject that his family's going to have to go through. But, you know, I'm just sitting there thinking, I'm like, God, that's so young, and with so much in front of him. And that just really, it kind of stuck with me the whole way home. And so I'm not rambling on about this because I know you're listening to this for baseball cards, but because this is still very raw and just a couple days old, you know, the news of Jose dying, you know, it just reminds me of something that a dear friend of mine said. I used to produce a radio show called The Chris Thomas Show. Chris Thomas was a longtime radio announcer, television sports anchor here in Tampa, a longtime sports anchor and radio announcer in Baltimore, too. If you lived in Baltimore in the 70s or much of the 80s, Chris worked for WBAL Channel 11. And Chris would say, and he ended his show every day with this. He said, tell someone you love them, and mean it, because tomorrow is not guaranteed. And he said that every day. And we unfortunately witnessed that firsthand. Chris passed away from pancreatic cancer back in 2004. But it is something that I remember to this day. And the Jose Fernandez story, you know, unfortunately, you know, really reinforces that. I mean, think about it. You know, Marlins, Braves, Saturday night, they wrap up at 10:30. Guys are in the clubhouse. All right, guys. Hey, Jose, see you tomorrow. It didn't happen. So, not to be Debbie Downer, but in all the sadness that has come from the Jose Fernandez tragedy, let's find some happiness, find something positive, and it's something that I tell my son, because, again, he has, you know, we've had the death conversation before, and you know, he's at that age where he has a lot of questions about, a lot of anxiety, too. I think everybody around the age of 6 or 7, they kind of go through that stage. So you can either worry about death, be sad about death, cry about death, or you can live life. And I choose to live life, and I hope you choose to do it as well. And Jose Fernandez, in his very short 24 years, he lived life. And I certainly hope that moving forward, those of us who love the sport of baseball, while we're saddened by his passing and especially the tragic circumstances around you, I hope that you can find the joy that he, by all accounts, had. And enjoy life, live life, and tell someone you love that you love them. All right, that's our somber portion of the podcast today. Sorry, had to get that out there because, again, you know, it's a four-hour drive. I mean, it's to get a lot of conflicting thoughts going on, you know, in something like this. You can only look at Sawgrass for so much and be, you know, entertained by it. All right, let's entertain ourselves with a look at 87 Donruss and Eric Davis, card number 265, our random pull for this week. And the 87 Donruss set looking an awful lot like the 85 Donruss set, and that is a very good thing because the 85 Donruss set, the first serious sharp set that Donruss put out, I mentioned I love their 86 set, 87. It's right up there. Very simple, as opposed to the Knight Rider red stripes that the 85 set had, the 87 Donruss set going with the black border. And the predominant photograph takes up about 90% of the front of the card. But going in the background with this rectangle filled with these almost clip art baseballs. This was 1987 after all. And it takes up about a third of the card, but it's not at the top. It's kind of floating around in the middle. But it's still, even though it's a very simple, somewhat aged look, certainly, you know, like I said, it's not new technology that made this. It is a very nice design, very simple design. You've got the Donruss logo in the upper left-hand corner. At the bottom, you've got the player's name and his position. And in the lower right corner, you know I love it, the team's logo. Anywhere you can put that logo, I'm all for it. Now, the front of the Donruss card, very similar to 85, and so is the back. If you flip over the card, you'll see that the card has the exact same design that Donruss have been going with since 1982 in terms of reporting stats, the same look for that design since 1985, and almost the exact same color. The 85 Donruss, a little more of a light yellow, 87 Donruss, more of a goldenrod kind of color. There's a nice old triplicate form color for you. Goldenrod. That should take you back to your elementary school days. So you have the card number in the upper left-hand corner in the baseball. You've got the player's name, personal information at the top third. You've got the recent major league stats, and then career highlights and other notes, if space permitted. And since Donruss only showed the previous 5 years of major league stats, you often had a few tidbits and notes underneath them. The Davis card, to nobody's surprise, is not the key card in this set. Donruss was able to really get a lead on certainly Topps in 87 and Fleer as well by producing a Greg Maddux rookie card. That is the top card in the set, and you can still get it very affordable. I've seen prices ranging anywhere from $40 to $60 for a Gem Mint 10 if you're going through the PSA grading. So the Greg Maddux rated rookie, yes, one of the rated rookies they got right, is a top card. Also of note, Barry Bonds' rookie card is in this set as well. Bo Jackson and Eric Davis's teammate in Cincinnati, Barry Larkin. Now, before we talk a little bit about Davis, let's wrap up our thoughts about the 87 Donruss set in general. Much like Fleer and Topps in 1987, even though all three companies put out some quality products, iconic products, for that entire decade, not just that year, this is where the market started getting bloated way, way, way too much with lots of cards here. Of course, the collection, the hobby just really boomed at this time, and everybody was just mass producing cards left and right. So the good news is it is very easy to get a hold of an 87 Donruss set, whether it's a complete factory set, a hand collated set, or if you're looking for wax packs like I used to collect, those are pretty easy to find. They're not really that difficult to find. You can find them on eBay for reasonable prices. You can get boxes for $20-$25. You can get complete sets for, you know, around $30-$40, depending on where you're getting them from. Now, the downside is if you're somebody who is looking to collect merely for value, this is not the set to do it. And that's not knocking 87 Donruss. I'm going to say the exact same thing for every set I talk about from 1987, pretty much through 1993, which is what I have cards for, because again, the hobby just boomed here. There was mass production of massive scale, you know, across the board here. So if you're looking for value, you're probably not going to get it here. The only value you're going to get is if you find somebody who is just trying to unload these cards, and there are plenty of people who are. You may find somebody that'll sell you a complete set, complete factory set for $10 just to get it out of their warehouse. Or you may find somebody that'll give you two boxes of wax packs for $20 just because they want to get it out of their warehouse. If that's value to you, where you're spending low and getting high in return on what you actually pull from that set or from those boxes, then there's value there. But if you're looking to buy something and sit on it for another 20 years, forget about it. It's probably not going to happen. Both with 87 Donruss or, again, any card set from here moving forward over the next 6 or 7 years. Now, with that said, and I'm going to say this as much in the podcast talking about this time period as well, you still have some quality sets. You still have some sets that look good. You still have some sets that have maintained their quality over the years, and 87 Donruss is certainly that. Again, you've got that sharp design. You've got some pretty good rookies in there. You've got a whole slew of young stars from the 1980s, and again, the veteran stars who were starting their careers in the late 1970s. So you've got plenty of star power, plenty of good young rookies, really a nice set. The 87 Donruss set is to collect, again, as a whole or through packs or through buying single cards. So I give the set itself an A. I think it's a really nice set. But again, if you're looking for value, you're not going to be able to pay off your student loans with this. In fact, you're going to be able to get some really good deals on it because there's just so much product that is out there. And again, it's not just settled in on 87 Donruss. This goes on for the next several years in the hobby. But if you want something that looks good, has some star power, has some players who are in the Hall of Fame, 87 Donruss is definitely a pretty good option. Now, as for Eric Davis, this is a guy who in 87 was really starting to hit his stride. He was just 25 years old in 87. It was his first all-star season, 100 RBI, 37 home runs, a batting average of .293. You could tell that this guy was on his way to stardom here. Of course, the Cincinnati Reds knew that. That's why they drafted him back in 1980, an eighth-round pick, and he certainly worked his way up through the Reds minor league system, getting some chances in 84 and 85, really getting a full season in Cincinnati in 86. And he was a pretty dominant outfielder for the Reds throughout this time. However, injury plagued. In fact, through his time in Cincinnati, never played more than 135 games in a season. And I'm sure part of that is due to the AstroTurf in Cincinnati, due to the style of play that Eric Davis had. He was very athletic, but somewhat reckless out there. And also, I'm sure, crashing into the cement walls in Cincinnati and the other cookie-cutter ballparks around the National League, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, St. Louis, Montreal, you know, all those parks back then. I'm certainly sure that did not help his cause. Now, I'd mentioned his key season in 1990, where he helped the Reds win their first world championship since 1976. He had a whale of a World Series, the four-game sweep of the mighty Oakland A's. People forget that the A's, who were defending champions, who had swept the Giants the year before, the A's were supposed to do the same thing to Cincinnati. You know, Cincinnati was a bit of a surprise in 1990. Well, the tables were definitely turned by the Reds. And one of the main reasons is Eric Davis. In four games, 14 plate appearances, a .286 batting average, one home run, five RBI. His defensive play was just spectacular in that series. And throughout his career, too, he was a three-time Gold Glover, all those coming in Cincinnati. And 1990 was his absolute best season in terms of a final outcome, in terms of being able to contribute to a championship season. Statistically, it wasn't his best. In fact, I would argue that 89 was probably a better season, or 87 than 1990. His two All-Star seasons were probably better than 1990, but really came to a head in 1990. Unfortunately, that was the beginning of the end. He suffered a lacerated kidney in Game 4 of the World Series, was never able to really rebound from that, struggle with injuries throughout 1991, and the Reds rather unceremoniously dumped him. They traded him to Los Angeles, along with Kip Gross for Tim Belcher and John Wetland in the winter of 1991. And there was a lot of animosity between the Reds and Eric Davis throughout this time, and understandably so. Of course, it's a little bit of he said, she said as to exactly what happened. But considering Marge Schott owned the Cincinnati Reds back then, I'm going to lean a little bit towards Eric Davis. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. You know, good old Marge Schott, who had her dog Shotzi poop all over the turf at Riverfront Stadium at any point in time, and also called Hitler not a bad guy. That's normally grounds for, I may lean towards the other person's perspective on the situation. Now, Davis was a native of Los Angeles, so a bit of a homecoming for him. Of course, native L.A. Player Daryl Strawberry had spent a year in L.A., so I remember going into 92, everyone was like, Strawberry Davis, guys coming back home. They're going to help, you know, the Dodgers continue to succeed. Of course, winning the World Series back in 88 didn't happen. The Dodgers hit rock bottom in 92, as did Davis. He played just 76 games that year, tried to give it a go in 93, couldn't do it. The Dodgers eventually had to trade him, sending him to Detroit, the Tigers in a pennant chase with the Blue Jays that year. They traded him for a player to be named later. Yes, the always famous player to be named later. It was John DeSilva going the other way. Of course, he didn't really pan out for the Dodgers either. A couple more seasons in Detroit. He missed the entire 1995 season due to injury, but then he was able to come back in Cincinnati. Had a pretty decent career, or a pretty decent season, I should say, in 1996 with a .287 average and 26 home runs. But then the redemptive second half to Eric Davis's career. In May of 97, he was diagnosed with colon cancer. He was being treated for that throughout the 97 season. He was able to return late in the 97 season. By then, he was playing for the Orioles. And he was the recipient of the Roberto Clemente Award and also the Comeback Player of the Year Award, as he had a phenomenal 1998 season with Baltimore. And then, unfortunately for him, it was kind of the beginning of the end there. After that great 98 season where he hit .327, had 28 home runs, and played 131 games with Baltimore, it was short stints in St. Louis and San Francisco, never able to play more than 100 games in one season, as he officially retired in 2001. With the San Francisco Giants. Now, he is still affiliated with the Cincinnati Reds. He is a roving coach, a roving instructor. So it's kind of interesting how he always comes back to Cincinnati one way or the other. But truly a tremendous athlete whose career was just robbed by injury after injury after injury. And then, of course, the cancer scare back in 1997, while he was able to put together a couple of really good seasons with Baltimore. I mean, that's going to wear you down. Of course, age on top of that, as he was able to wrap up his career over the next couple seasons in St. Louis and San Francisco. So Eric Davis, part of the big Red Machine part two, if you will, the 1990 World Championship team, Eric the Red, a guy who in 1987 looked like he was going to be the next Willie Mays. In fact, there were a lot of comparisons of his play to Willie Mays, but unfortunately those injuries and that cancer diagnosis cutting that short. But very happy to report that he is a guy who is still very active in baseball, still working with the Cincinnati Reds. And despite the animosity that he had with the Reds in the early 90s with his first departure from Cincinnati, they've kind of kissed and made up. Obviously, he's working for the Reds, but also he is a member of the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame. So, Eric Davis, our random pull and our look at the 1987 Donruss set, card number 265. Again, a quality set if you're looking for star power, rookie power, design. It is a beautiful set, but if you're looking for value, don't go overboard with this. Bargains are to be had. And if you want a nice set for a little investment, this is a good set to do it. If you're looking to refinance your house with sales of 87 Donruss, unless you want to live in a van down by the river, I would not do that. So there you go, 87 Donruss, a sharp set, one that I like. The career of Eric Davis, Again, very fortunate to see him in his heyday with that 1990 World Championship team in Cincinnati. It's a great set. Of course, it's part of the overload that came in baseball cards in the late 80s and early 90s, but hopefully stirred up a few positive memories for you, not only if you're a Reds fan or an Eric Davis fan, but a fan of the hobby and collecting a beautiful set in the 87 Donruss set. 87 Fleer is next. We will discuss that in Friday's podcast. Fleer also putting out another quality set, and we'll do a random poll from our collection here. We'll answer your questions and comments at Wax and Gum Stains, and we look forward to hearing from you as you hear from me in our next edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in. Tell a friend about us. We'll see you next time.